Question is, why does God take so long? Think about it for 8 seconds. Think about it for 8 seconds. Don't answer yet. Just think about it. Why does God take so long? Why does God take so long? See, you're already answering. You're jumping the gun. You got to take a long time. All right, so we got one answer. To teach us patience. What are some other answers? Why does God take so long? What came to you? Yes. Because he's super old. He's so old. We're so young. So I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. You're not saying God is decrepit and slow moving. You're just saying his time frame is just so much different than ours. That because we're young, we think that an hour is an eternity. All right, Catherine, what you got? Because he's slow to anger and rich in love. He moves slowly because he doesn't jump to conclusions, or he's not given to emotional outbursts. Mind, what you got? Because he enjoys the process. You have to unpack that one a little bit, but that's good. That's a rich one. Yeah. Somebody over here, who's got the answer? They're taking too long. They're just thinking about, they're all contemplative. To build suspense, like a good movie director, build suspense. What you got, Andrew? He reacts when he knows his time. He has the benefit of full knowledge and full information. So when it's time, it's time. He's not going to jump the gun. That's good. Yeah, one more. Al, what you got? Because he's never, ever tardy. Now, that's a concept Blue Water could think about a little bit. Like, what would that be like? What would that be like? Never tardy. Sometimes asking why God is taking so long is a little bit like asking why God makes things hard, why things are challenging, right? Like, if everything in life were instantaneous, then one gets the impression that life would be easier. I'm not exactly sure that's true, but certainly delays and uncertain stretches of time can test us and stretch us. We know that to be true. And anybody in this world who wants to walk through life powerfully as a free, purposeful individual will have to get the hang of time dissonance, right? Of waiting and not knowing and being stretched as we delay in seeing what happens. We're in the sermon series on the book of Exodus, which is about that. It's about becoming a free, purposeful individual on planet Earth. Exodus nominally is the story of God taking the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. We've decided in the course of this Exodus series that taking people out of slavery is the easy part. Taking slavery out of people, that's the hard part. And so most of the stories in the book of Exodus are precisely about that. How do you take slave-mindedness, cravenness, smallness out of a people and turn them to actual free, purposeful individuals, full children of God? And it turns out that quite a bit goes into that. We started the sermon series by talking about how at some point in the journey, people who want to be free individuals are going to have to develop the capacity to go beast mode. You're going to have to become the kind of people who are willing to charge into a land screaming at giants who inhabit it. You got to be willing to take on whatever challenge. We talked about the problem of settling into the gray in life. One of the first things God does in the Exodus story is that he makes comfortable slavery into uncomfortable slavery for the Israelites so that they realize the direness of their straits and actually want to change, begin to embrace change. We talked about the lure of reasonable compromises. Pharaoh offered the Israelites all manner of reasonable sounding compromises. No, you don't want to go off and worship God on your own. You want to stay here. And it sounded very reasonable. It sounded like a reasonable dialogue. But what it was is just a tyrant trying to keep them in slavery. You have to be suspicious about compromise in life. We talked about the necessity for free individuals to make enemies. We should love our enemies, but if you don't have any enemies, you're not really trying. Because the world is a contentious place. You can't be at peace with the devil. Never make peace with the devil. Never make peace with the tyrant trying to control you if you want to be free. We talked about escaping the tyranny of fear. It's a story of facing down the Egyptian army and needing deliverance to come, the parting of the Red Sea. We talked about escaping the tyranny of need, which is the story of God providing manna, miraculous bread in the wilderness, providing for us out of nowhere. Because most of us live under the tyranny of material need, we let it control our lives, even if we're doing well. We talked about how hard it is to get free of victim mentality, and if you've had a period of trauma or slavery in your life, the temptation to think of yourself as a victim forever is strong, and if you think of yourself as a victim, you're certainly not thinking of yourself as a free individual, and that's problematic. We talked about getting free from prey mentality. Prey mentality happens when you realize that the world is a dangerous place. And then you get so devoted to caution that it controls you, it shapes you, it runs your life. And that can be super destructive. If you want to be a free, powerful individual, you can't think like a prey animal. You are not, in fact, a rabbit. God begins to teach the Israelites the basics of self-governance, which is interesting. Stories about that get included in the book of Exodus because he doesn't want a bunch of robots. He wants people who are schooled and taking care of themselves, handling their own business. He's developing free individuals, not controlled androids. We talked about the necessity of going priest mode, not beast mode, but priest mode. Priest mode is when you're just a weirdo, right? You're set aside, you're different. And God says that he's trying to make of us a kingdom of priests, people who just look weird in the world. You have a special calling. And if you're not willing to look like a weirdo on planet Earth, you're never going to be a free individual. You're just going to be a crowd follower like everyone else. You're going to be one of the normies instead of one of the weirdos. Everybody say priest mode. And then comes the point in the story of Exodus where God starts to give the Israelites rules, you know, the Ten Commandments, and then all the smaller commandments that follow the Ten Commandments, which are really just practical applications of the Ten. And rules get a bad rap today in our culture, but good rules are fantastic. Bad rules really, really, really suck. If you don't have the capacity to be a rule keeper, then you will be controlled by any tyrant who promises you freedom from rules. If you think you can live free from any rules, then you're not very dedicated to reality. So be a rule keeper by any means. And then we talked about God's end stage goal, which is really to make the Israelites, really to make us people of his presence, people who carry his presence in the world. And the whole like final third, at least, of the book of Exodus is God schooling these humans in what it takes to be people who carry the presence of God with them, who live in a real physical manifestational relationship with the living, speaking God. Humans tend to forget that that's the goal. But that is the goal, even in this life, even in this life. And then today, finally, we're going to talk about how that all gets tested. We're going to talk about the temptation that people face to not abandon what they believe, but to conveniently revise what they believe in order to manage the dissonances in life. Are you following me? I have lived long enough now, I am old enough now, the perspective of decades is really starting to form my thinking. I've been walking with the Lord a long time, I've been ministering a long time, and one of the hard things about walking in faith in this world for decades is that the brothers and sisters who walk with you sometimes fall away. Right, they sometimes don't make it, and I've got to watch, people fall away from the Lord, and some of them really destroy their lives. What has struck me about that experience repeatedly is that I am often surprised about which ones are the ones to fall away. And so I've begun thinking, well, you know, what does it take to last? Maybe I misunderstood that at the beginning. I know one of the things that is not telling is passion. People that are passionate about the Lord in their 20s are just as likely to fall away as people who are just complaining grinders with the Lord in their 20s. Passion comes and goes. That's not it. You know, it has more to do with discipline and resolve and things like that, which we talk about a fair bit at Blue Water. I was thinking, as I reflected on this concept this week, about a pastor friend that Sonia and I had when we were in their 20s. It was a church that we'd sort of helped plant, helped grow for sure. It had gone from like, I don't know, maybe 30, 35 people when we first joined. And then by the time we left and I went off to grad school, the church was about 600 people. We did my first community house experience there. I was living in a ghetto with a bunch of guys and just living with a bunch of crack cocaine addicts and stuff like that. It was a super formative time. There was a pastor on staff who took an interest in what we were doing and wanted to turn our community house effort into a church plan and all that. Long story short, he ended up writing a bit of software. He's a smart guy. We were in Silicon Valley. He wrote a bit of software on the side, just sort of as a hobby. It got bought by a company. He became rich and almost immediately didn't just quit ministry. He just left the Lord. He just left the Lord. He wasn't experiencing the ministry success that he thought he was. And this was a guy who wielded a fair bit of authority when we were walking with him. He was grounded, he was smart, he was involved, he had resources, super prophetic guy, and then fell away almost overnight. And that was maybe one of the first big ones that just baffled me. It's like, how in the world? Like, how do you wake up one morning and decide that it's all garbage? You know, and what he did, what he said in explanation was like, well, I don't think I ever really bought it. You know, you hear that sometimes? I hear that a lot from people who fall away. Well, I was never really that into it. And I always cry foul. Yes, you were. You were totally into it. You were so into it that you would reprimand me for things that you thought I wasn't into enough. That's not it. But people have a great capacity to conveniently misremember their own history with God. It's just astonishing. And I think that's a huge factor that doesn't get enough thought. Like when you think about your own history, your own experiences, your ability to revise them in post is extraordinary. And I've just seen that take a lot of people out. I learned to my great heartbreak that Rhett and Link recently left the faith. Do you know Rhett and Link? If you are a parent of children of a certain age, you know Rhett and Link. What is it? No. Well, they did. They began writing songs for the VeggieTales movies together. They were friends. They're former Campus Crusade staff workers. And then they started this Good Mythical Morning podcast, which became huge, millions and millions of followers. My kids grew up on them, thought they were great. And then there's been a wave recently, sort of starting with the COVID pandemic and all the shutdown and stuff, for Christians, particularly younger Christians, to deconstruct their Christianity. There's even a phrase for it. So they decided that they were going to deconstruct their Christianity, and then they released a 2.5-hour podcast explaining why they were saying no more to God. And their explanation was precisely this. It's like, well, like we believe, but we never really thought hard about it. I said, really? Because you were international representatives of the faith. You were Campus Crusade staff workers. You were professional ministers. You fundraised, and you never thought about it? People have an incredible capacity to misremember even recent history. And it's another example of people who are extraordinarily successful, but it doesn't help them. You know, it hurts them. I have a theory that has to do with why so many kids fall away from the faith when they go off to college. Kids who are Christians in high school, they go away to college. the stats on them keeping their faith are really abysmal. Some studies say that 75% of them will lose their faith by the time they graduate college. And I think it's because kids learn to believe, and so they do, but they don't learn to fight. They don't learn to endure. They don't learn to wrestle. They don't learn to seek. They don't learn to question and grow. All of which sustain belief in a world that despises belief, right? So you can teach belief. You can come to belief. That's only part of it, people. Then you have to learn how to fight. Then you have to learn how to endure. And you have to learn how to handle questions and doubts that come, because they'll come. You're a human being, in case nobody's ever told you that before. So how do you handle the dissonance? How do you handle the delays, the waiting, the troubles? And people fall into this trap where they start to believe that it's not supposed to be difficult. And then somebody asks them a question about God they've never considered, and they're like, well, I guess I got to quit the faith. It's like, well, I don't know. Here's an idea. Learn something. Here's an idea. Push back. Overcome. You know, walk the walk. You get the point. It's so easy to cave. It is breathtakingly easy to cave. Not just to cave into a temptation, but just to cave in your faith. It is so easy in the world. Never underestimate how easy it is to walk away from faith. And people need to be inoculated with that. I didn't say vaccinated. Let's read Exodus 32. So this is a long passage. Pardon me for this. I try to break it up sometimes, but I'm going to read the entirety of chapter 32 in the book of Exodus. It's one story. It's the story of the golden calf. And a lot of you know the story. How many of you know the story of the golden calf in the book of Exodus? All right. So what's happening here, I explained this last week, is Moses has come down, has met with God in the mountain. He's come down and he's explained to the Israelites the Ten Commandments and associated laws, and then says, hey, are you guys in? Do you like this? And they say, yes, we're in. And then he takes all the elders, all the leaders, and they go up the mountain a little bit, and they have a picnic with God himself in the presence of God. They have a phenomenal physical manifestational encounter with God. And then Moses explains to them, this is how it's supposed to be. We're going to build a tabernacle. This presence, this guy, this manifestation of God is going to be with us forever. It's going to be very exciting. They're like, this is awesome. Again, we're in. And then they do a little contract ceremony. And they pledge that they're going to follow what God says and stick with his presence and stuff like that. And then Moses is like, all right, great. It's official then. I'm going to go up the mountain. I'm going to get the hard copy. I'm going to get stone tablets that the Lord is going to prepare that has the law written on it. And then I'll come back and we'll keep those tablets in the tabernacle and we'll go on our way. That's the plan. So he goes back up the mountain. And he's up there a while. I guess, you know, stone printers don't work any better than normal laser printers. You know, it takes a while. They have to order a new one, Amazon. I don't know what happens, but he's up there for like 40 days. Why does God take so long? And it's never really answered, but he's up there for 40 days, and this is what happens. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron, who's Moses' brother and a priest, and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. How soon they forget. I just want to point out what I think is a bad translation. Come, make us gods who will go before us. That word gods is the word Elohim in Hebrew, which is a, technically it's a plural word. Technically it does mean gods, but it's also the name that the Hebrews use for God himself as a sign of respect in Hebrew, as is the case in other languages. You refer to a king using the royal we, the royal plural, right? So it says gods, which is sort of technically correct, but really it's just Yahweh. It's just God. So what the Israelites are asking is, come, make us God who will go before us. Make us an image of God, please. Because Moses left. We don't know what's going on. We want a statue. We're in it for the idols. That's what it means. Follow me? As for this guy, Moses, I don't know. He's apparently abandoned us. Aaron answered them, well, take off your gold earrings that your wives, your sons, and your daughters are wearing and bring them to me. Remember, they had looted the Egyptians, so they had all sorts of gold bling. So all the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aaron, and he took what they handed him and made it into an idol cast in the shape of a calf, fashioning it with a tool. Then the Israelites said, these are your gods, O Israel, or literally, this is God, Israel. This is God, Israel. Here he is. This is God, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. This is the guy who did it. When Aaron saw this, that they liked it, he built an altar in front of the calf and announced, tomorrow there will be a festival to the Lord. So the next day, the people rose early and sacrificed burnt offerings and presented fellowship offerings. Afterward, they sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in revelry, which is an interesting word. I'll say more about that. It's a very poignant word in this passage. Revelry, to indulge in revelry, you can sort of imagine. Then the Lord said to Moses, go down, because the people whom you brought up out of Egypt, which I think is just funny. You did this, Moses. People you brought up out of Egypt have become corrupt. They have been quick to turn away from what I commanded and have made themselves an idol cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it, and have said, these are your gods, O Israel. Again, this is God, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. I'm going to go version 2. We're going to try this again. These people are making me angry. But Moses sought the favor of the Lord, his God. A lovely phrase. O Lord, he said, why should your anger burn against your people whom you brought out of Egypt? This is just a great conversation. With great power and a mighty hand, why should the Egyptians say it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to wipe them off the face of the earth? Extraordinarily clever prayer. Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self. The Israelites cannot remember their recent history. Moses is asking God to remember ancient history. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Remember all that, Lord? Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster that he had threatened. Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hands. He's like, whew, all right, no disaster. They were inscribed on both sides, front and back, which is an interesting detail. The tablets were the work of God. The writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets, another physical manifestation. When Joshua heard the noise of the people, Joshua is Moses' assistant accompanying him. When Joshua heard the noise of the people shouting, he said to Moses, there's the sound of war in the camp. Moses replied, oh, it's not the sound of victory and it's not the sound of defeat. It's the sound of singing that I hear. It's revelry. When Moses approached the camp and saw the calf and the dancing, his anger burned and he threw the tablets out of his hands, breaking them into pieces at the foot of the mountain. I love that. He's like, oh, Lord, Lord, don't be angry. It'll be okay. And then he gets down to see what's going on. He's like, dang it. Throws a tantrum, breaks the stones. It takes 40 days to get them. It's just a great story. And he took the calf they had made and burned it in the fire. And then he ground it into powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. This is awesome. This is the ancient version of washing your mouth out with soap. He said to Aaron, what did these people do to you that you led them into such great sin? And this is Really cool. "Do not be angry, my lord," Aaron answered. "You know how prone these people are to evil. They said to me, 'Make us gods who will go before us.'" Again, make us God who will go before us. "As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. So I told them, 'Whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off.' Then they gave me the gold and I threw it into the fire and out came the calf." Some things never change. Human nature. Moses saw that the people were running wild and that Aaron had let them get out of control. So he sees what they're doing. They're still doing their nutso revelry stuff. And so became a laughingstock to their enemies. So he stood at the entrance to the camp and said, "Whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And all the Levites rallied to him. The Levites happened to be his own tribe and the priestly tribe. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth through the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother, friend, neighbor." The Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 of the people died. More about that in a moment. Then Moses said, "You have been set apart to the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers." He's saying this to the Levites, "and he has blessed you this day. It is good sometimes to choose sides." The next day, Moses said to the people, "You've committed a great sin, but now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses went back to the Lord and said, "Oh, what a great sin these people have committed. They have made themselves gods of gold, but now please forgive their sin. But if not, then blot me out of your book you have written." He's interceding. The Lord replied to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. Now go, lead the people to the place I spoke of." I'm going to blot out only the people who transgressed. "Now go to the place I spoke of. My angel will go before you. However, when the time comes for me to punish, I will punish them for their sin." And the Lord struck the people with a plague because of what they did with the calf Aaron had made. Goes on from there as Moses continues to intercede for them that the Lord would not take his presence from the camp. That's a story that we'll get to later. So it's a story of Moses going up the mountain and taking too long for the Israelites' comfort. And this overlong Aaron turns into disaster. The calf that they made, like you're thinking, well, why a calf? Why a golden calf? It was the idol of the region. Like all over that region, even today, you'll find altars with drawings of calves and cows on them. The calf represented any number of local gods, but right around there, the god Hathor. It would have been like the cool religion, you know. So in getting a calf and making a calf, Aaron was essentially saying, look, you know, this is the popular image of God. And so that's what I'm going to give you, the popular image of God, the acceptable image of God, the one that everybody relates to. And so it was a gimme. It was an obvious symbol. That's why the golden calf. And then he declares a festival unto this idol. And there's talk of indulgence and revelry and all of that stuff. So what happened essentially, and you see this in the details of the story, is that the Israelites got insecure. They say, well, look, this God who was present now no longer is, because my gosh, it's been 40 days. Make us a god, and then we will worship it. Make us a god that looks like the popular god, and then we will worship as people popularly do. But the way that people popularly worshiped their gods in that region at that time was extraordinarily disgusting. So first you'd eat, you drink, and you'd get drunk. And then there'd be wanton, widespread orgies and ritualized sex and rape at the altar. Usually you would rape children. And then in other places, I don't think this happened in this instance, but then you would sacrifice children. It always involved human sacrifice. So when the Lord judged the Canaanites in the land for their perverse sexual perverse religious practices. This is what he was judging. Widespread, industrial size human sacrifice of children after raping them. You know, it's some nasty stuff. So I don't know how much of that exactly was going on here, but when it says they got up to indulge in revelry and Moses came down from the mountain, first he was like, well, I'm going to be compassionate with them. And then he sees what they're actually doing. And it is so nasty and so overwhelming that he just throws a fit himself. As kind-hearted and gentle-spirited as he was, as much for them as he was like, this cannot stand. This must be judged. That's what's going on, just so you know. And that's why he says, who's for God? And the Levites are like, us. And then he says, all right, we got to kill them. It says, you know, it sounds like he's saying we have to kill everybody. And they end up killing only 3,000. There are probably, you know, hundreds of thousands there. What they did when they went around with swords is that they killed people who were in flagrante delicto, if you know the Latin, who were in the middle of the act. What act? Well, the acts that I just described to you. It's like, you know, hey, let that kid go. That sort of thing. So this was a really macabre afternoon. It was a nasty business. That's essentially what the story is. Of course, I don't know the details exactly, but that's sort of what the narrative suggests, and that's what the history suggests. What bugs you about this passage? Well, I mean, what bugs you about this passage at the first instance is, how in the world did they abandon God so quickly? I mean, like, right there toward the top of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not make any carven images, any graven images. Like, you do not make idols. And this whole tabernacle thing was explained to them. Like, you're not going to make idols, you're just going to make a space. You're not going to make a god, you're just going to make a space to meet God. Like, what the heck, people? How did that happen? How did you cave so easily and so wantonly? Right? You swung so far over to the other side so quickly. What the heck? And, you know, that probably bugs you as you read the story. It bugs me, and it has bugged me a lot through history as I see people fall away. And I think, what in the world? You had everything. You had encounters with God. You had richness. You had success. Why in the world would you fall away so easily? I mean, there was not even a good reason for it. What? He was 40 days on the mountain. He told you where he was going. Like, what the heck? So what explains that? So we're only 3 or 4 months into the Exodus story here, and Moses has been gone away for 1 month, 40 days up the mountain. So that's a significant proportion of time. So I don't know exactly what they expected, but if you're 3 months into a journey and then your leader leaves for 1 month, maybe you feel a little bit abandoned or a little bit confused. He probably did not leave them a timeline, and he didn't take his phone. So they can't contact him. So maybe they begin to suspect, oh, something terrible has happened. God killed Moses, or, like, you know, all of these rumors would have flowed through their head. So, you know, they freak. And this time, they have freaked a lot in the story, but this time Moses isn't there to rein them in. So that's part of it. It's their first weekend without their parents. It's the first time away from home when they go to college. And, you know, people show up at their dorm room with temptation, and they just don't have the muscles to deal with the test. And they probably are plagued with the idea that being free means being like the cool people. And so, you know, they chose the cool idol and the cool religion and the cool practices. There's the revelry factor, which is like, you know, once the guidelines start breaking down, it's really easy for a crowd to turn into a mob. We're talking about this in my Ohana group this week, and Catherine mentioned, well, it's like Burning Man, which, if you don't know, is this big rock festival, is that right? It's an art festival in the middle of a desert. But it's just revelry, you know, and it's like people that go way out into the wilderness away from any adult supervision, even though they're adults, and then just anything goes, right? And so people start walking around naked, they start dropping acid, and pretty soon it's just okay, you know? And that happens sometimes when you get off by yourself It's like, well, I've heard about this stuff. I've always thought about doing this stuff. I guess this is the time I can do this stuff. You can always rationalize revisions is the moral of this story. You can always rationalize revisions and misbehaviors and apostasies. It's always possible. Don't kid yourself. It's always possible. Moses, again, super humble guy. When he sees what's actually going on, he punishes the perversion by the word of the Lord. The Israelites had forgotten that there were such a thing as consequences. And so when Moses shows up at camp, he reminds them, what you are doing leads to death. Let me show you. It's for reals. It's for reals. And sometimes when we get off by ourselves with a crowd of people who don't really help us very much, we can forget that there are consequences to our behaviors. We can forget that there is a living God. Even if we had just seen him 40 days ago, we can forget. It's so easy. It's so easy to conveniently misremember. And then it's easy to forget that there are consequences, that there are judgments, that God doesn't really like evil and wickedness on earth because it leads to destruction and he would rather not go there. There are consequences. So again, like a college kid being tested independently for the first time, they never learned the art of wrestling. They never earned the art of seeking. They never learned waiting. They learned believing, but they did not learn trusting. They think it shouldn't be necessary. And that's a question you ask yourself sometimes when you're in a waiting period or a period of temptation or a period of isolation. You say, oh, yeah, you know, is all that stuff really necessary? I mean, do I really have to do all that stuff that way? I mean, what would it hurt if I just sort of relaxed, revised, gave in, went with the flow, experimented? I'm just exploring. I don't know what I think right now. I'm just, you know, pretty easy to go there. You can always say, well, what ifs? What if I misunderstood that commandment? You know, what if it really wasn't as real as I thought it was? And then you don't quit. You just revise a little bit. You make it easy on yourself. It's like, well, you know, maybe I didn't ever really buy in. And I'm still deciding. You know, you can tell yourself all manner of things like that. But I'll tell you, the muscle of belief is different than the one for trust. The strength that you use to believe is different than the strength that you need to overcome and persevere. And it's a lesson that all of us have to learn. At some point in your life, no one will be watching you. Or no one who cares will be watching you. In fact, maybe you'll have an audience that is egging you on toward destructive behaviors. Somebody who's giving you sympathy or empathy in a way that leads straight to hell. And it will be your first solo flight, or maybe it will be just your most recent test during a period in which you're kind of tired of waiting. And you're a human being, which means that you can rationalize any choice you want. You can rationalize anything. No matter what you've encountered from God in the past, you can always, always rationalize away your faith and convictions. And that's something you need to know if you want to walk as a free, powerful individual on planet Earth. It's something you need to know. And hopefully you get to know that without consequences, right? Hopefully you realize that you need to choose sides and stick with them. Because the world is always trying to seduce you away toward evil, even if it looks convenient and comfortable, even if it can be rationalized. A sobering story, during a really epic story of God doing extraordinary miracles and visitations in order to turn people into free individuals, which is his agenda for every one of us this morning, every one of you. It is worthwhile to read such stories and to contemplate them because they help us make decisions and stick with them. They help us maybe repent from destructive conveniences, which I think is a great phrase. destructive convenience. Yeah. Anyway, I'd rather choose the Lord's side. Even if he has been conspicuously absent for a while, I'd rather choose the Lord's side because I think he's coming back. So Father God, I pray that you would minister to your people this morning. These are people that are designed to carry your presence, who are trying to design a life to carry your presence. Sometimes it feels like you're not very present, to be honest, Lord. I don't know why you take so long. But that does indeed seem to be the nature of things here at the edge of your holy mountain. I pray, Lord, that you would visit us with a good old spirit of conviction with victory, that you would give us victory over things, whatever the trial is. Speak, Lord. Your children are listening.